And welcome to Black Market Photo, episode 39 for Monday, the 1st of July 2013. It is I, your humble host, DJ Payne. And on this week's episode, we have Michael Kenner. That's right, prolific English landscape photographer. Michael Kenner and I were able to recently sit down and have a great conversation at the AIPP event in Hobart. So we're also going to catch up a little bit about that. All that and much more on this week's Black Market Photo. How you doing? I'm glad to be back with you. After an unscheduled week off last week, we're back. We're back with you at Black Market Network headquarters here. It is raining like crazy up here on the Gold Coast where we're stationed. We might be floating away very shortly up here in Queensland, but All that considered, we're very excited to have some amazing interviews in the bag after this AIPP event down in Hobart, Tasmania, Australia. So from the 15th to the 19th of June, we were down there in Tasmania. Now, this was my first ever trip to Tasmania. I've never been down there before, so therefore I had never been to Hobart. So I was able to spend a few days in Hobart. And let me just say right off the bat, Hobart, I've fallen in love with you. Hobart is just an amazingly beautiful place, and from the small amounts that I saw and consumed and was able to enjoy, I'm definitely planning a trip back there. I want to take the family down there for a holiday, maybe not in the middle of winter when I nearly froze to death, but soon, maybe in autumn, maybe in summer, we're going to head on down, take a holiday. I cannot wait to get back down to Tasmania. What a beautiful, beautiful place. Now, this was my second ever AIPP event. I went to the first one that I'd ever been to was last year in Newcastle in 2012. So this was my second event. And I think it's only the fourth event that they've held in total. So I missed out on the first two and have been to the last two. Now, this one was absolutely fantastic. Amazing venue, amazing location. But the biggest reason why you go, and the really 99% of why you're going there, amazing people. And I'm not just talking about the speakers and the people who are giving classes and lectures and everything like that, but I'm talking about everybody else, people in the trade show, and just all the attendees, just fantastic people to catch up with. Now, like I said, I have come back with literally a bag full of recordings of interviews with amazing people. I might give you a little bit of a heads up about what we're going to who we're going to be hearing from after this interview, but I don't want to talk too much about stuff. I don't want to give you a lot of information. I want to get straight into this interview because it's so good. Michael Kenner, who turned 60 this year, was one of the keynote speakers at the AIPP event. He is just an amazing, moody, just takes the most beautiful pictures of landscapes around the world. He's originally from England. He spent a lot of time in California as well, and just a wonderful photographer. So him and I were able to sit down and have I just really enjoyed being with this guy. He was just a great guy, a wonderful person to talk to, and I'm hoping that you're going to get as much out of it as I got out of it when we're actually having the conversation. So without much further ado, I'll be back after the interview to tell you some more news about all things Black Market Network. But right now, let's get straight into that interview with prolific English photographer Michael Kenner. And welcome back to the Black Market Photo Podcast. This is the last podcast I'm doing chronologically here at the AIPP event. And without sounding too cheesy, I've saved the best till last. I've got sitting opposite here with me, with a wry smile on his face, Mr. Michael Kenner. Thank you, Michael, for joining us.
Good to be here.
Now, when I was running around talking to the powers that be and to the attendees here, who do I interview? Who's the best? One name came up more than any other, and that was Michael Kenner.
I bribed them.
Okay, all right. Well, I didn't see any cash flowing out there, but it worked.
Yes.
Now, I like a num-num, I have missed out on your keynote talk the other day.
Yes.
And haven't been able to do my usual due diligence and research on this. So what I was hoping to do with this podcast is, I'm sure that a lot of people listening who are portrait and wedding photographers and those budding fine art photographers
yes.
are going, who's Michael Kenner? Never heard of him. What's all this about? You know, people listening all over the world. So if it's okay with you, we'll do a bit of a retrospective. We'll have a look at the career
sure.
and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Where did you originally come from? Where were you raised?
Well, I am English, but I now have two passports. I also have an American passport as well as a British passport. I was born and brought up in the north of England.
Okay.
A little town called Widnes. It's a very industrial town. My family was quite poor. I was born into an Irish Catholic family.
Okay.
And I remember very much that I spent the first 10 years of my life, as much as I can remember, just kind of wandering around this town, mainly on my own, using my imagination a lot. And I think that was the core of my photography comes from these early years in this small town.
Yes.
There was a lot of industry. Which I later used in my work. There was a park that I spent a lot of time in, which I used a lot of in my work also. There was a train station. There was the Catholic Church, which I spent a lot of time in. In fact, when I was 10 years old, I thought the best thing I could do with my life as a career would become a Catholic priest. I did ask my parents at that point, could I become a Catholic priest? And of course, being the youngest of an Irish Catholic family, they were overjoyed. I went to a seminary school.
Wow.
And I was a boarding school.
That was after high school or after?
Yeah, 10 and a half years old.
Wow.
Yes,
oh, 10 and a half years yeah. straight into it.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a boarding school, and I spent the next 7 years there.
Wow.
Which was also a great, it formed the way that I see the world, I think, and the way that I approach the world. It was very disciplined, of course. Mm. There was a lot of silent meditation, praying, ritual. Suddenly I found that I had my own bed for the first time in my life.
Well, how big is a family? Is it a stereotypical?
Yes, I have four brothers and one sister. Wow. And Granny also lived with us. So
wow,
there was
wow.
a tiny house. You yeah. know, there was five boys in one little room, for example. So
wow.
It was nice to have the freedom of your own little cubicle, my own drawer.
So going away to boarding school
yes.
and going into a seminary mm-hmm. was a great experience for you.
Oh, it was a very good experience. Yes,
yeah.
It was quite liberating, actually.
Fantastic.
And as I say, you know, of course, when I got to be a teenager, I realized that this perhaps wasn't such a great idea.
Mm.
I say that, and then people always say, "Well, why?" And I say, "Well, of course, there are girls." I didn't know.
10 and a half. There wasn't girls.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
They didn't exist at that age.
There was me, my imagination, and God.
Quite
and then
right.
at 17,
yeah.
I'm like, "Oh, there's
yeah,
girls
somebody
out,
else
there.
Out there."
Was there a by that stage, was there photography in the picture? By the end of boarding school, not at all.
Okay. It's just that this seminary school was a one-track career. Basically, mm-hmm. you were either a priest or you left.
Mm.
There was no career guidance,
mm-hmm.
So I had no idea what I wanted to do. They advised me to stay on until I was 18 to finish mm-hmm. all my studies, which was actually a good thing for me to do because the level of education I received in this school would have been much better than what I would have received in my hometown.
Okay. Where was the boarding school?
It was a place called Upholland.
Okay.
It was only maybe 12 miles from my hometown, but it could have been another continent.
Really?
Yeah.
Because it was a small town.
September the 4th, I left for boarding school. I didn't speak with anybody from home, see them, anything until December 26th.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's just like once you're there, you're there.
Yeah.
There's no form of communication back home again.
Wow.
But anyway, finally I decided that what I seemed to be reasonably good at was doodling and art and drawing and painting. That's what I absolutely loved to do.
Mm-hmm.
So when I left the seminary school when I was 18, I went to an art school.
Was art part of the education at the seminary?
I almost forced it to become part of it.
You wouldn't stop drawing in the books.
No, art was part of the syllabus until I think 15 years old.
Mm-hmm.
They'd never ever had it taught after that.
And
myself and two other students really wanted to continue to do something called A-levels. I don't know if you have O-levels and A-levels in Australia.
We don't, but I'm aware of it, yeah.
Yes. And so, we convinced the teacher to actually teach us just part-time.
Mm.
Just after his other class, he would just give us things to do. So
like
essentially,
a private tutor.
Yes, just for half an hour a week. That was it. That was our tuition. But we all graduated and did very, very well. And
awesome.
I love doing it.
So coming out, you're like, this is my passion.
Yes, yeah. And so I went to art school in a place called Banbury in Oxfordshire. My mother had died in the meantime. My father had remarried.
Okay.
Then moved to this small town called Banbury, and that's where I went to art school.
Okay.
And I studied art for a year, multimedia. I studied graphics and painting and pottery and metalwork and knitting and and photography.
Yeah. Okay. So photography that was your introduction to photography.
That was my introduction.
Great.
Yes.
Great.
And I think it was during that time that I realized I needed a profession that I couldn't be a painter. I wouldn't survive in England. I needed a profession where I could survive commercially, financially.
Mm.
Photography, maybe retrospectively, I realize now, but is a profession where you can do it commercially and you can also pursue it as a means of self-expression.
Mm-hmm.
And very few other medias you can do that.
Mm.
So I decided to apply for a three-year course, both in graphics, because I was very good at graphics, and in photography.
Mm-hmm.
I applied to the same college in both these courses. My photography interview came first. They accepted me, so I decided to go to that. I never went to the graphics interview.
Well,
things could have been very different.
Yeah, the other way around. So from the first year of art school into a three-year course for photography.
Yes, and then I specialized just in photography for 3 years, and I studied all aspects of photography, sports photography, fashion, still life, the technical issues of printing, color printing, all sorts of different forms of photography. And, I always had landscape photography as my kind of hobby.
Mm.
You know, even if I was doing some sort of commercial work, I always maintained the landscape photography on the side.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't, in England, even consider that one could survive by, pursuing any form of landscape photography. That really was a hobby.
Because there was more of a fine art type of thing,
and you were
focused on a commercial business.
Yes. Okay. I needed to survive. So I came out of the school essentially a commercial photographer.
Mm-hmm.
I got a job, first of all, I got a job selling photographs on Fleet Street for Magnum, which was very bizarre but wonderful.
Wow.
And then I got a job as a printer for an advertising photographer, and then I became his assistant. And so we did car commercials and still life and food photography and portraits and so forth. And I continued making my landscape photographs.
Your hobby on the side kept on
yes.
going. So how long did you work for the commercial? How long were you assisting him and working for that commercial photographer?
Probably for about a year.
Okay.
Maybe backtrack a little bit. When I graduated from photography school, I went to the United States for the summer as an exchange student. And it was only there that I saw galleries in New York exhibiting photography, which put little seeds, some people actually do survive doing this funny thing called photography and selling prints. So after the summer, I traveled in Mexico and Belize and Guatemala and all these places. But then I had to come back, and that's when I started working on Fleet Street.
Mm-hmm.
And then I continued my professional life,
doing
whatever jobs I could get. I did record covers and book covers and some still life and things. But it wasn't thrilling, I must say. But after a while, I needed adventure, I think.
Yes.
I was offered a partnership in this studio, and I just felt too young to kind of know what I was going to be doing for the next 25 years.
Mm.
So I went back to the States.
Okay.
And
How old, what age are we talking when
we're talking about 24 or something like that now, 24. I went back to the States, and then a whole new adventure began, essentially. I got a job working for Ruth Bernhard in San Francisco as her black and white printer.
Wow.
I found that I worked I did all sorts to survive. I worked as a framer. I cut grass. I painted houses. I made beds,
Anything you could.
Anything just to survive.
Mm,
mm. But eventually I started putting roots down, and I think through Ruth Bernhard, I was able to kind of understand that, galleries did exist, and and I started taking my portfolio around.
Okay, and now what did your portfolio consist of this time?
At that time, it consisted of all these color studies of bodies, because this whole study of body motion when I was as my graduate thesis kind of thing in photography school. So I essentially was touting this color portfolio.
Yeah.
And I did get it in a gallery in New York and a gallery in San Francisco, and it was there for maybe a year, 18 months, nothing sold.
Just
no reaction, completely dead.
Wow. And that didn't squash your hopes right there.
No, I don't think so. No. I think, photography is one of those professions that you, well, like all of professions in the arts, you, if you have a passion, you just keep going regardless.
No matter if the public says, no, thank you.
Yeah. But at a certain time, you have to be pragmatic. Mm. And it was actually my gallery in San Francisco, because when I originally showed work, I showed them color work and black and white work. Mm. And after about a year, they said, well, you know, it's not working, Michael, you know. Well, let's try the black and white, you know, just see what happens. And so I pulled all the color work out and started putting my black and white in. And I think after 6 months, my first print sold.
Wow.
It's called Trees Richmond, and it sold for $75 or $50, whatever they sold them in those days. But but it was great.
And you're bang, I finally made a sale. That was it. You're now a real photographer. Yes. That's it. Yeah.
So I started printing. You know, I worked during the day on whatever I could to make money. Mm-hmm. I assisted other photographers, mm-hmm. but I began to print more and more of my own black and white work and tried to place it in the gallery. And it's over the years, you know, sales began to happen.
Mm-hmm. And then, now, the black and white work you're talking about, mm-hmm. was landscape work?
At that time, yes, it was landscape work, mainly made in England during my student years.
Okay.
And then, of course, once I was in California, I started photographing in California too. Mm-hmm. Then I became influenced by the great. Earlier, I'd been influenced by the great European photographers, you know, Agé and Bill Brandt and Joseph Sudek. But now I saw Ansel Adams and Joseph Stieglitz and Ruth Bernhardt, who I was working with, and so it gave me a different palette in terms of my printing. Mm. But it was a slow progress, but. Eventually, I had a few galleries that represented me, and they sold the occasional print. Mm-hmm. You know, I certainly couldn't survive on it yet. Mm-hmm. It was a side business almost.
Now, when you say eventually, what time frame are we talking? We're talking months, years?
Years. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I would say my first successful exhibition was in 1981 in San Francisco.
Okay. And by successful?
Successful meaning it sold 70 or 80 prints.
Oh, great. Yes, okay. Yeah.
Again, only for $100 or whatever.
that's something.
But yes, and I won an award that year, the Imogen Cunningham Award. And so it was, I felt like there was a good prospect in mm-hmm. this in mm-hmm. this career. Mm-hmm. And ever since then, I've been doing pretty much what I do now. I photograph, I print, I exhibit them in galleries, I try mm-hmm. to make books. Mm-hmm. The career is taken off, but it's been almost 40 years now. Yeah. So it takes a while. It's not something that just suddenly happens.
So do you remember the point, or how long from that successful show mm-hmm. to when you were able to say, you know what, I don't have to assist, I don't mm-hmm. have to cut grass, yeah, I don't have to mm-hmm. print somebody else's work, I can just do mm-hmm. my work? How long was that process?
All the way through the 80s I had other work. Mm. You know, I most of it was printing for Ruth Bernhardt, because mm-hmm. that was very allied to what I was doing, and it really refined my own printing techniques, mm. and occasionally I would do commercial work. Mm-hmm. Then in 1991 I had my first commercial agent mm-hmm. in London, and so I began to get more interesting. You know, before that I was just doing odd commercial jobs, not very interesting ones. Mm-hmm. Then I began to get some interesting ones. I worked for British Rail, mm-hmm. And I had this, you know, national campaign. I traveled around on all these amazing trains and photographed landscapes. Mm. Then I started photographing. I got a job for Rolls-Royce. Mm. Then I had Mercedes and BMW and Volvo and like a whole slew of cars after that. Mm-hmm. This was pre-digital, of course.
All film.
Yes, all film.
Yeah. The good old days. The good old days. Yeah.
And so it's probably, I would say, the early 90s was the time when I basically gave up printing for anybody else. And a long time previously I'd stopped being an assistant. Mm-hmm. And after that, I don't think I've really worked for anybody except in, you know, my own terms commercially.
Yep. And, so let's fast forward to now. It's still based mm-hmm. in the U.S.?
I'm based in Seattle now, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And still, what's the process for you now? Do you mark on the calendar, right, travel on these dates to shoot, mm-hmm. and then come back and cull, and then printing on the, like, is it as organized as that now for you?
No,
or is it much more organic?
It's a lot more organic. Yeah. Of course, I do have to plan ahead, because I have a lot more exhibitions and more and more. I can't remember, somebody said I'd had 351 person shows, and I've never counted them. Somebody did.
Wow. Okay.
But this year I probably have 12, or last year I had 12 or 15.
Yeah.
I already know in October I have to be in Belgium, France, the Ukraine, and England for exhibition openings within the space of 3 weeks. So there's already time. And I will photograph around that time, of course, too. Mm. And I knew I was coming to this wonderful event here, so yeah. I've planned an extra 2 weeks to be in New Zealand to photograph.
Yeah.
Sometimes I plan purely to go away to photograph.
Yes.
And nothing else. Sometimes I connect it with business. Sometimes I connect it with marathons because I love to run.
So oh, wow.
I've run like over 50 marathons now, but I always associate it with, if I'm running the Boston Marathon, I try to get an opening in Boston at the same time.
Wow. Okay.
It's very peculiar, but it's it takes a lot of planning.
Yes.
And I do most of it, but it's it works out very well.
You don't have anybody else working for you, managing?
I have one assistant. Mm-hmm. He actually lives in Portland, which is 3 hours away. He has a big studio there, and I have a big studio in Seattle. Mm-hmm. So I am at this point in the somewhat luxurious position of doing most of the creative work, which means that I go out and photograph. Mm-hmm. I come back and I give the film to somebody else to process and to make proofs. Mm-hmm. I do all the printing myself still because I think that's an integral part of the process for me.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk technical for a minute because you just mentioned, and a lot of people's ears would have pricked up, you're shooting film.
I still shoot film, yes. I use these old Hasselblads, most of them from the 80s. Yeah. Occasionally I get new bodies I drop them in the rivers or and I do frequently.
Yeah.
I get sand in them and all sorts of things. But
And so you're shooting, with medium format film?
Yes.
In that black and white film?
Yes.
And then going back, developing and printing?
Printing everything myself, in the darkroom.
In the darkroom, old school optical.
Old school, yes.
Fantastic. Yeah. That is a... have you experienced, in all of your travels, a bit of a revival amongst film shooters and darkroom sort of thing becoming popular?
I honestly don't follow these trends. I really don't know what's going on.
Okay.
And I don't. I mean, I almost don't care in a strange way. I've found that along the way that if you have a certain vision or passion or direction, then you should be following it, not always looking over your shoulder or looking to the left or right and seeing what other people are doing or not doing. So certainly the gallery sales are up and down depending upon the economic times of the country. I find that I basically have global representation at this point. So hopefully somewhere on the planet the economy is doing well.
And you focus on that country at that time.
Sometimes it's in Korea or China or it's in Russia or Europe or USA or, it's depends. Mm. But nobody is doing well all of the time.
No, that's it. So you mentioned also that you have your own studio. Now, is that a studio as far as for shooting?
No, not for shooting.
Okay.
It's purely for all the logistics of the dry mounting, the retouching, the storage, the print files, the negative files, the darkroom, of course. Mm-hmm. All this sort of stuff takes up a lot of space.
And
it's amazing if you've been working at this for 40 years, how much you accumulate all these archives of stuff.
Well, you've at least got all the old bodies full of sand that have been dropped in the river and everything.
Those I give away usually.
Now, something that you're renowned for, and a lot of people who came out of your talk the other day, the words that I heard floating around was passion and integrity and a real strong sense of who you are and what you want to do. Where do those things come from?
I think they come from your upbringing. I think they come from your own personal challenges along the way. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, particularly the early upbringing, I think, in Widnes and then going to boarding school, I think they were challenging times in a sense, and your own resilience becomes very, very important.
Okay.
And after that, it's really just staying true to yourself, staying true to your own vision, not being deflected by current fashions and trends and vagaries of the market. Mm-hmm. And you really just have to... It's really just staying true to yourself, I think. I don't really know I don't know the answer because I'm often asked, how do I become successful? Yeah. How do I do this? How do I do that? I don't know.
I just stumbled
into it. I have no idea, exactly.
Okay, well, let's break it down a little bit further. You say stay true to yourself. Mm-hmm. I'm sure we have some people listening who are going, yeah, but I don't know, like, what self am I being true to? Mm. Like, what, where does that resilience, or where does that discovery or epiphany come from, that you go, I know what I want to do and I'm going to do this? Mm-hmm. Where did it come from for you?
For me, I think it's, again, it comes from my background.
Okay.
I didn't really have that many doubts as to which way I wanted to go. Mm. But at the same time, I realized at many stages I've had these fortuitous circumstances, happenings that I don't know why they happen, but they always ended up happening, that I ended up in the right place somehow. Mm-hmm. I remember very, very vividly when I was looking for my gallery in San Francisco, for example. My friend in his bathroom had a poster on the wall for a gallery, and I won't give the name of the gallery because I don't want to give things away too much.
Yeah.
But I said I will take my portfolio to that gallery, which I did. That's what I did. I went, took my portfolio, went up the third floor of the elevator, lots of glass windows and doors, went to the gallery. The gallery owner was there, and he had a Harold Edgerton show, who did a lot of these body motion studies.
Mm.
And I had my body motion portfolio.
Mm.
And he looked at the portfolio and said, well, maybe we'll take this work and see what happens. And that was the Stephen Wirtz Gallery, who still represent me today. Mm. And that was in 1978.
Wow.
The thing is, I'd walked into the wrong gallery.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
How did you manage that?
Because there was a new construction. He'd just moved in.
Wow.
And I literally walked in the wrong. He didn't even have a sign over the door.
When did you realize it was the wrong gallery?
When I came back a month later with my portfolio to give to him, and I was distraught that I was in the wrong gallery. I'd been telling everyone, I'm in this gallery.
Yeah.
And then suddenly I wasn't.
Yeah.
The other gallery, of course, went bankrupt. Yeah. The one that I was going to. Stephen Wirtz is still there today.
Yeah. So it was all meant to be.
Many, many happenings like that.
Now, personally, when the limited exposure that I've had to your work, I would describe it as being, very, and people will take this word in different ways, but I would describe it as definitely a massive sense of, there's a spiritual sense to the work. Mm-hmm. There's a real, there's a not only a moodiness and everything like that, but there's a spiritual sense. When you tell me about your upbringing and your desire at 10 and a half to say, hey, I'm going to be a priest, is that part of it? Is there a line that we trace from there, or is it a different thing?
I was talking in this, when I give a slide talk, I've found that if I don't prepare it, it's much better.
Yeah.
So I literally put all these slides together and I just start talking.
Yeah.
And then I don't know where I'm actually going to go to until I get to the end.
Do you remember what slides are coming up next?
Not usually.
Yeah.
No. And it makes it more interesting for me also. But I was telling people about my early experiences in the churches that I'd go into. I would sit, and there was always, I was an altar boy for many years also. And I believed in these, these rituals of baptisms and funerals and, the
Catholic
masses.
Faith.
Yes, yeah, it was very, very strong part of me at that time.
Mm.
So in a Catholic church, there's always one light that sits next to the altar.
Mm.
There's an altar, and there's something called a tabernacle in which the host is in within.
Mm.
And that light for me always had this feeling that there was something that I couldn't see, that I acknowledged, that I had reverence for, I paid homage to.
Mm.
But I couldn't see it.
Mm.
And in my photography, I'm always looking for that light.
Mm.
I'm always looking for the invisible.
Mm.
And I try to make it visible, but at the same time, I like the power of suggestion rather than description, I say. So I photograph questions, enigmas. I photograph the space in between. I photograph the atmosphere that's left behind rather than the physical object.
Mm.
And sometimes it's difficult to articulate. That's why I'm in a visual field rather than a writer or an orator.
Yeah.
I use a lot of pathways that go over horizons, around buildings. I have lots of plank walks that leave space for one's active imagination to go out, to be alone, to sit, to think, to be zen-like, whatever, to meditate.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of veils of mist, because I photograph a lot in the morning. I photograph at night when I can't really see what I'm photographing. There's a degree of unpredictability about that.
Mm.
But it all does seem to come back to this feeling that there's something out there that we can't see, that it's basically a faith that there's something. I don't know what it is.
Mm.
I don't pretend that one religion is better than another one or has more answers than others. Or But I just know there's something else than the physical object that we photograph. So I think it kind of, it lies somewhere in that feeling.
And oftentimes I believe, and again, you can correct me if I'm wrong, and I don't want to jump on your train of thought there, but the artist's role, and especially, you know, this is for me, I mean, to cut a long story short, I turned 40 last year, and I finally said, after being a photographer for 20 years, I'm going to put on my own exhibition with my own artwork.
Yes.
It was a lot on the bucket list of things to do, all right? So that kicked me into doing it. And the challenge for me was, okay, well, what am I going to photograph? And what do I actually want to say? And what is it? So that started a process, because I could think of great imagery, but what did I actually want to say? And in the end, through a roundabout, you know, circumstances, I ended up going back to the parables of Jesus, of all things. And I realized that Jesus, you know, in the teachings that we have in the New Testament, in the teachings that he gave, he veiled everything. He didn't come out plainly and say ABC to the point where his disciples actually came to him at many points and said, will you just say what you want to say? And his point it was, and it really inspired me in the artwork, was those who have ears to hear, you know, will hear it. And those who are meant to see what they're meant to see will see what it is. So that was a liberating thing for my work, that I could express this longing or feeling for the other, as you say, and it'll resonate with those who are meant to resonate, you know, the type of thing. Is that something that you find similar in your work, or?
Similar, yes. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to, again, I don't want to use your ideas or words either. But I often say that I'd like to, I mean, I'm strongly influenced now by Japanese art and by the Asian aesthetic in general. And I've often alluded to my own work as a kind of a visual form of haiku, in that there are just a few elements like haiku, but there's the power of suggestion. There's the idea that a viewer, or myself as the photographer, can come into the image and finish the image, use one's own imagination, experiences to see something. I often say that none of us see the same photograph.
Yeah.
We all see it through kind of the lenses of our own imagination. And that's a wonderful thought to me.
It doesn't trouble you as an artist to think, this means this to me, this is saying this, and someone comes along and has a totally different experience.
No, I absolutely love it. I mean, as somebody working in the arts, it's about sharing, really, and communicating. You know, I know that I'm in this privileged position of, you know, having spent all these years of searching, exploring, looking, seeing. So I get to places that most people never get to. You know, I'm up on the top of mountains, and you know, 5 o'clock in the morning, or I'm in an abbey at, you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning when there's absolutely nobody there. I'm in some basement or some industrial building, or just very, very interesting locations, and I have the ability to photograph them and kind of bring those visual experiences back and share them with an audience, and that's a powerful thing to do. And it's also a highly, I think one needs to treat it with great amount of respect and responsibility, because it's easy to kind of take advantage of your own position in a sense and make it very much a reflection of yourself, as opposed to, you know, people, again, I say people, but photographers often consider their work their own. And I don't. Because if I'm out photographing a mountain, it's not my work. You can say it's God's work, or you can say it's the earth's work, or it's the mountain, it's the landscape, but it's essentially we're collaborating. You know, there's this huge collaboration going on. And I always believe in this theory of equal exchange of energy, whether it's in a relationship, you know, whether it's any sort of commercial proposition, or whether it's in a photographic situation too, that I feel that whatever I photograph is kind of organic. I'm part of it. It's part of me. We're all in this together. And so there has to be a certain amount of respect. I don't like the feeling of being a paparazzi.
No.
Of like stealing, taking things. I do not like that.
You want to give something back as well.
So it's either with the landscape, you say, you know, it's like making a portrait. You know, I'll make you beautiful as I, you know, as I possibly. And there's a respect in that, I think.
Do you want to, a couple last questions and we'll wrap it up. In the end, what do you want your legacy to be? Like when the work that you leave behind, you mm-hmm. know, when you know people in, you know, 100 years from now pull out the Michael Kenner book, mm-hmm. or they look up that on Wikipedia, yeah. you know, or whatever it is in the future, they get the app on their phone or whatever it right. is. Mm-hmm. What how do you want it summed up? What are you wanting to say?
I don't really have an answer for that one. Yeah. It's not really up not to me almost. It's not even a concern.
Yeah.
I mean, I do, particularly as we get faster and more crowded and noisier and more colorful. Everything is cluttered these days. All yeah. our time is kind of spent, you yeah. know, doing all this persnickety little bits and pieces. I like to present work where it slows people down.
Yeah.
It makes them calm. Mm. You know, it allows them to ground, to mm. be on their own, to mm. be in solitude, to go into a landscape in solitude, not feel intimidated in any way. Mm. I like that calmness, mm. That almost meditative, you know, again, church-like, you know, monastery, mm. Temple. You know, mm. I love visiting all these shrines. Mm. These are places for me of great calmness, great mm. solace. Mm. And so if my images have any of that, what for me is a very beneficial mm. effect, mm. then I'd be very, very happy.
Is it wrong for me to draw a line from your desire as this young kid in England, mm-hmm. you know, by himself with his imagination in mm-hmm. these urban spaces, desiring to be a priest, mm-hmm. to where you are now, desiring to, you know, take people into this calmness, into mm-hmm. this other? Is there a line connecting those two people?
I'm sure there is. It's, yeah. you know, I don't think we drastically change unless we have some major trauma yeah. happening along the way. So mm-hmm. I'm still the 10-year-old in yeah. many ways, but I have certain experiences, and I think perhaps I'm a little more pragmatic into yeah. in those days, you know, the priest was the most beneficial and powerful person in my life.
Yeah.
He controlled everything, mm. you know, and I, as an altar boy also, you know, when I saw him with his great robes and great shoes and a good hat, you yeah. know, the bishop, and,
yeah, yeah.
and you know, being in administering all these rites yeah. and these rituals was really phenomenal for me. Mm. And so today, I don't want to be in that kind of position of power.
No.
I'm not interested in that at all.
Yeah.
But I love it when all my images can go out and be in any way kind of healing forces
yeah.
or forces of benefit or mm. forces of beauty or mm. calmness or any of this. You know, mm. I want them to benefit people, certainly.
Yeah, I can definitely see. I can, you know, you might not draw the line, but I'm gonna draw the line.
You can do that.
look, fantastic. Thank you so much for your time.
Great pleasure.
Mm-hmm. I'll put some links in the show notes for this show to your work.
All right. Yes. Yes.
Is there anywhere? I know that you're in everything that you're saying there. I can't imagine that you're all over social media or anything like that.
No.
But is there anywhere online that if people want to connect with you or see?
Oh yeah, they have a website. Yeah. yeah, and it's very easy. Just michael@michaelkenner.com.
Yep. Yeah.
And that has a huge amount of images. It's yes. constantly changing. It yeah. has updates of all the exhibitions and books and publications and whatever else.
Fantastic.
My assistant runs a Facebook fan page, but I don't really look at that very much.
How did I guess that you weren't going to be a fan on your own fan page there? Yeah, exactly. Excellent. Well, we'll yep. put all the links in there.
All right,
and,
lovely.
And we'll let yeah. And we'll let everybody know. But Michael, thank you so much for your time.
Great pleasure.
My heart on my grave. Baby, both said the angel. Things can go either way.
Market Photo. Now, I tried to warn you. I told you that it was an awesome conversation. I told you that he was a great guy. So hopefully, I'm just hoping that you got let's see, if you got 50% out of that conversation what I got out of it, then you, this has been the worth of, you know, worth your time and energy and downloading and listening to the show. But Michael Kanner, thank you so much for your time. I feel like we just covered all the groundwork. We've got the foundation of your career covered, and we're ready to have part two of the conversation. There's so much more I'd love to talk to Mr. Michael Kanner about. But first thing first, I encourage you all to head over to the show notes of this of this episode. Head over to the show notes on the blog and have a look at the work of Mr. Kanner. Have a look at some of the work, have a look at some of the samples, and head over and look at the websites that I've linked there. He's just an amazing, prolific photographer. Some beautiful, beautiful work. You really have to experience it. And now that you've heard the whole conversation of his career, you definitely want to head over there and have a look. Now, I usually save the end of the podcast here for some, you know, some housekeeping and, you know, talk about all the, you know, stuff that's happening with the Black Market Network. And we're going to keep it really brief for this episode because we've just had a great conversation. But I just wanted to give you a little bit of a, one of the biggest things that's happening behind the scenes is we've put all our heads together, you know, the whole Black Market Network. And by that, I mean, there's myself, there's David doing Q&A strategy, Paul Atkins doing Q&A photo, and Steve Saporito doing Q&A strategy. We've got together with a few other consultants and experts in the industry and stuff like that, and just basically my time spent talking to everyone I could at the AIPP event in Hobart, we've come away with one big thing that we want to change with the network. At the moment, if you want to listen to all four shows, you've got to subscribe four separate times. You've got to go to the four separate websites or to four different places in iTunes and get the shows all separately like that. Not that there's anything wrong with that if you're an absolute podcast freak and you know exactly what you're doing. But for a lot of people, and for most people that we talked to, it was all just a bit too hard. And it was also sort of fragmenting our audience as well. So what we're working on right now is to have one simple place for you to go and subscribe to everything in one hit. So it'll have one website, one iTunes feed, one podcasting RSS feed. So you just have to go to one place and bang, you get all four shows. That's what we're working on right now. We've been testing how everything is going to work across multiple platforms and devices and everything like that. And it's all working. It's going to take us a few weeks to get it all transferred over. But we want to have it really, really simple. So you just go to one place, you subscribe to all four shows. You don't have to think about it. Now, for those who are concerned who only want to get one of the shows or they're not interested in the other ones, don't worry. We'll have ways for you to be able to do that. But for the vast majority, we just want everybody to go to one place and subscribe and listen to all the shows. That makes the most sense for us as a network. So there you go. That's what we're working on. Give you a little sneak peek of that. I was going to mention some of the amazing photographers that we've been able to talk to at the AIPP event. I'm going to save that for next week. We've got a lot of great shows, a lot of great conversations and interviews that have been recorded, and a lot more that are coming up in the works. We've got some really, really great people we're going to be talking to soon. So I'm really, really excited. Okay, guys. That's enough from me. Thank you so much for yet again tuning into the Black Market Photo. Anybody who's new listening and you've listened this far, big thumbs up. Thank you. Welcome to the fold. Keep on subscribing. Give us your feedback. You know all the places to go to. At the moment, you know what? Just head over to blackmarketnetwork.co and you'll get everything from there. All right. That's enough from me. Once again, thank you, Mr. Kanner, for your time. And this has been episode 39 of Black Market Photo. We'll talk to you next week.
Hey you can subscribe to all of the great podcasts of the Black Market Photo Network in iTunes. And while you're there, go ahead and rate all of our fantastic shows 5 stars. It really means a lot to us. Come and say g'day to us and all of the gang at blackmarketphoto.com, where there are links to all of our social networks like Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and all that yada yada. A huge thanks to everyone who supports this show and the entire network. You can do that too and be the coolest kid on the block at blackmarketphoto.com/support.